Psychedelics powerfully alter your brain by tapping into the serotonin system. This is something we're going to be talking about today because these drugs have been seen in the past to have lasting negative effects, right? But in recent years, in clinical studies, they've also been shown to possibly alleviate depression faster than any other existing treatment. But we are going to talk about some limitations to those studies. And we're also just going to talk about psychedelics generally, how they affect the brain, what they are, why they produce the kinds of consciousness-altering, profound experiences that many people have on them. We're going to go into the science as well as some of the existing literature on the therapeutic side of things, but that is going to be the focus of today's episode. Welcome to The Social Brain. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Taylor. And this is a show where we dive into how the brain works. If you've ever wondered what's going on inside your mind, even the things that you're not even aware of, then this is the place where we can unpack that and really explore it. All right, welcome back, everybody. Like Andrew hinted at the beginning of the episode, we're going to dive into psychedelics today. This is something that we've actually gotten a lot of requests to do this episode. It's taken a while. This is kind of a touchy subject, right? There's a lot of hype around psychedelics, around this potential that they have to alleviate lots of different types of suffering, right? And something that we really wanted to make sure of and be clear on is what the limitations of these studies are, because with there being all of this hype out there, we want to make sure that we're looking at the methods and whether the methods of these studies are actually right to be making the conclusions that are being made. And what we have to say is that there is some really promising stuff that's coming from these studies. But we also want to kind of take it with a little bit of caution, right? There's a lot of people out there that are suffering tremendously from things like depression, from PTSD, from anorexia is one of the things, end of life treatment, all of these things that are being thrown out as potentials for psychedelics to treat. But I want to make it clear that, like, there's no guarantee that taking a drug like this is going to alleviate any of these symptoms, right? And we're still in the process of figuring out how this stuff works in the brain, what it's doing to the brain, how it's actually affecting these different symptomologies. So we're going to try to get into all of that today.
Yeah, definitely. We're trying to take a really balanced view, not demonizing them and not glorifying them unnecessarily. So there's a lot of interesting work, a lot of like really inspiring, promising work, like Taylor said, but also some questions and some unique challenges to working with psychedelics in scientific clinical settings that we'll also talk about. But first, like, we're just throwing this word around, psychedelics. What are psychedelics? Well, first, the term psychedelic, is derived from a term, basically it means mind manifesting, psychedelic. And that doesn't tell you a whole lot about exactly what they're doing or how that term is actually used in scientific and clinical circles. But basically these substances do a number of things to kind of alter consciousness and alter brain function. And they often generate perceptual distortions, including hallucinations at higher doses or in certain circumstances. They can induce synesthesia, so kind of like the mixing of perceptual faculties. You might hear sounds or see, you might hear colors or see sounds, or have a kind of emotional synesthesia, so to speak. Also malleable or like hypersensitive or potent emotional states, emotional experiences. That's a kind of a key feature of some of the clinical work too that we'll get into. And then just other psychological changes, maybe mental fluidity or lucidity in some cases. So that's kind of an overview of, I think, what these substances do. We'll talk more about like the pharmacology later on, why they have this sort of distinct set of psychological effects.
And something that, like, I really want to put out there to really think about is that none of the other drugs out there do what these do, right? I mean, you drink a beer, you smoke some weed, whatever it is, like, those don't alter the entire like conscious state like these do. Some of the people that have been doing the research with psychedelics for 20, 30 years talk about how people will come into their office and they'll ask them, like, how was the experience? How did it go? And they'll say, you know, that was one of the most meaningful times of my life. Like, you know, I got married, I had a child, and I did 6 hours with a blindfold on with psilocybin. Right. They put it up there in those. I mean, you don't look back and say, you know, that beer that I drank that changed my life. Right. But there's a lot of people that have these types of really meaning making type experiences, right? Existential experiences where it really kind of makes them think about their life, think about, and we're going to get into what might be going on in the brain that kind of puts people into these states where they're thinking about the world in a different way. They're looking at the world in a different way. And we want to be clear too, because the word psychedelic is thrown around a lot to kind of encompass lots of different types of substances. The traditional psychedelics, the ones that really are going to be the focus of what we're talking about today, are the ones that hit the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor. And those are psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. This is LSD. This is DMT. It's in ayahuasca, been used in these like ceremonial services in South America. And then also the mescaline, which is in peyote, cactuses and stuff that's been used in like Native American ceremonies as well.
Yeah. And interestingly, we'll also get into why serotonin itself is not really a psychedelic or isn't thought to be, but that these substances that specifically hit the 2A receptor are. And I have an old video on that, on this system and on serotonin in general, really complex system. We'll get into it a little bit later, but yeah, Taylor mentioned some of these kind of, these like shamanic ceremonies that use ayahuasca in the Amazon rainforest. That this has been, there's like a rich history of people taking psychedelics for thousands of years. I think it goes back, there's archaeological evidence going back, yeah, thousands of years, people taking perhaps psychedelics, and it's at least gone back hundreds of years. And so that we just want to like acknowledge there is this rich history both in the scientific world, but also in these kind of native tribes and indigenous peoples have been using these substances for ceremonial, for religious purposes, for healing purposes. So ayahuasca has a history in the Amazon, whereas like peyote, a cactus that contains mescaline, has been used by like North American, Native American tribes for spiritual purposes and ceremonial settings. So this goes beyond just the recent history of recent scientific history and goes kind of back into even to perhaps to prehistory, who knows, but yeah.
I mean, this is a big reason why there's all of this fervor to study this kind of stuff, right? Because it's been such a profound part of the formation of many cultures. I mean, some people go as far as to say, like the Stone Ape theory, that it was psychedelics that then led to language and all of this stuff. I don't know where we're at with that stuff. But the really interesting thing here is how powerful these things can actually be. And I really want to come back to the term that Andrew brought up at the beginning, the etymology of this word, like where this word came from, is all about mind revealing. And that's what a lot of cultures and what a lot of the researchers are kind of looking at in terms of what's going on, is that somehow it's kind of revealing a lot of the stuff that's under the surface that doesn't usually come to conscious awareness, right? Our conscious experience is usually incredibly filtered. It's filtered to our beliefs, our goals, our attention, the things that we're heavily focused on, right? Something we've talked about a lot on this show before is this idea of attention and how incredible attention is, because we're getting bombarded with billions of bits of information every single second, everything we're feeling and hearing and seeing and tasting, all of that stuff, right? But somehow we're filtering all of that stuff out. And like most consciousness researchers believe that we're only aware of like 2% of what our brain does, right? And so there's something going on with these substances that seems to be possibly some of these models we're going to talk about, maybe kind of loosening this filter, maybe kind of revealing more to consciousness than is typically kind of we're capable of because of the really strong mechanisms going on during kind of healthy living and all of these kind of things. But it makes it a really kind of interesting things to study, not just from a therapeutic perspective, but from a trying to understand how consciousness works in the first place. Like, what is it about changing these systems in the brain with these serotonin receptors that are hit by these substances that then completely alters what is being kind of brought into the awareness space, and how our kind of predictive nature is altered, and all of these things that we're going to kind of get into. Like, these are really, really fascinating substances. And that's a lot of the kind of pursuit behind wanting to do this episode. I think we have done more research on this episode than like the last two or three combined, because there's so much out there that really, like, there's a lot of a fervor around really trying to understand all of this stuff.
Yeah, it is just fascinating, all the different angles you can take to think of how powerful these might be for kind of revealing what's going on in the human brain, what's going on in our experience and our conscious experience. Because even some of the researchers who are skeptical about the like therapeutic potential of these substances are not skeptical that they are going to be useful for understanding human and neuroscience and psychology. So there's a lot of like interesting stuff that we can learn from these substances, regardless of how useful they are therapeutically. But so maybe we talked about the therapeutic potential a little bit. We could get into kind of where this idea came from, because this has emerged in recent years that psychedelics may be useful for depression and anxiety, but this research actually goes back a lot further. I think even to like the 1960s or prior to that, because there was some, I think the first research on this was looking at LSD for basically alcohol use disorder, alcoholism, and findings that were at least really promising at the time that LSD could be really beneficial for helping people to quit and stay off of alcohol. So that was maybe one of the first indications that it would be useful for psychiatric conditions.
And we got to keep in mind that this was underground for a long time. I mean, there was this kind of hippie revolution in like the 60s or whatever. And there was a lot of people anecdotally that were reporting that these experiences had drastically changed the way that they viewed themselves, the way that they interacted with others, the relationships in their life improved, like all of this stuff. So there have been people kind of underground practicing and doing these things with people to help alleviate things like depression and, like Andrew was saying, like addiction. And it's been really hard to bring it into the lab because of these drugs having the class that they do in terms of being illegal, right? And it's really hard to go through kind of an international or internal review board to get approval to do these kind of studies, giving some type of illicit substance to your subjects, right? Finding the subjects that are suitable for these studies, like all of these kind of things. But I think that a lot of that anecdotal stuff really led to some really kind of passionate researchers putting their kind of careers on the line to really kind of jump into this space and to see whether there's something going on. And it's interesting to me, I don't know if you kind of saw this, Andrew, but something that I noticed getting into all of the researchers that are really prominent in this field is that most of them actually came from Europe. There are quite a few that have now made the transition and are now doing this work in America, but you have Franz Wohlenweider in Switzerland. You had Robin Carhart-Harris actually started over in London, now is doing work over here. You have a bunch of people at Leiden University over in Europe. So it's interesting that it seemed to kind of break a little bit first in Europe in terms of getting these approvals. But now there's kind of a switch, and now it's opening up a lot. I personally live in Oregon, and they are actually, it's the only state that has kind of decriminalized psychedelics, and they have facilitation centers here to do therapy. I actually have a really good friend that is a facilitator here in Oregon. So it's really interesting how a lot of the politics have played out and where that's kind of going.
Actually, I have to correct you there, because I live in Colorado, and we have also, I think as of 2 years ago, decriminalized what they called it natural medicine, which was supposed to include things like mushrooms and a few other things. So yeah, we're maybe not as far ahead as Oregon is, but yeah, it's slowly happening. And I think it's just as an aside, it's probably no coincidence that two of the first states that legalized marijuana, Oregon and Colorado, are two of the first states that decriminalized psychedelics for medicinal purposes.
Yeah. So it's really interesting because this has led to what we're kind of getting at is a lot of this research that has gotten a lot of popular hype in terms of what this is doing for people with major depressive disorder that are treatment resistant. They've tried certain medications, they've tried certain therapeutic approaches, and their depression seems to be really resistant to a lot of the kind of on the market strategies that are being done right now. And these studies that have been done are showing really promising results in terms of follow-ups with these people. And this is something we're going to get into in terms of limitation, because we have to keep in mind that depression is a cyclical disorder, which means that it may go away right now, but it's cycles, right? And so having a long-term follow-up is really important for these types of studies. I don't know how long the longest one is right now. I have seen, I think, 6-month follow-ups is the longest I've seen. But if we really want to know if this is working long-term, we need to be doing like year, 2-year follow-ups, because so much of depression too is contextual, right? Taking some illicit substance in a therapeutic setting might like make you feel better for a while, but it doesn't get rid of abusive partners. It doesn't get rid of poverty. It doesn't get rid of these things that lead to depressive episodes, right? And so we have to keep a lot of that in mind when we're thinking about the efficacy of things like this.
Yeah. And just to kind of add on to that, when it comes to these psychedelic assisted psychotherapy situations, it's very different from conventional medicine, conventional antidepressants, where, you know, the physician or the psychiatrist prescribes this drug and you take it. And maybe along with that, you're at the same time doing cognitive behavioral therapy or some other form of therapy as kind of an adjunct or putting those together. Yeah. This is very different. This psychedelic assisted psychotherapy is basically where you have a small number of sessions. Like usually it's like 1 to 3 sessions. It may be more than that sometimes, but it's like you have typically 2 psychotherapists there. And before the patient ever takes the drug, they develop a rapport. They go through all the, you know, here's what to expect from this kind of thing. And then they take the drug. It's often psilocybin in that set, in this like controlled clinical setting. And then they're sort of being guided through the experience with a therapist. So it's a really a lot more focused sort of like, you know, one time or 1 to 3 time event that is facilitating this therapeutic process. And that's kind of how a lot of these researchers talk about it. It's not that the drug itself is shifting you from depressed to not depressed. It's that it kind of opens up this window in which therapy can occur a lot more effectively. And it's sort of a facilitating that therapeutic experience that occurs in the context of somebody being like having the so-called psychedelic journey or tripping, as many would say.
And I think that's a really important point to really kind of get into right now, because what you're talking about with taking antidepressants is that's the traditional form of medicine and how medicine is tested through clinical trials and things like this, where you just kind of get a pill and you go and you take it and you go through your daily life. You can do therapy. You might not do therapy. It's really hard in this context to tease apart what parts are actually beneficial in terms of what are creating these lasting effects that may be coming out from these results, right? And something I do want to kind of correct a little bit, a lot of the studies that have been done with actual therapists, that there's two therapists in the room. But I know in Oregon, you don't have to be a therapist to become a facilitator, that you can actually go through facilitator training and become a facilitator without any of those credentials. But you have to keep in mind, though, that it still is kind of a therapeutic setting. There are these kind of getting you ready for the experience sessions that you'll go through, building trust, building rapport with the facilitator. Then there's the actual session, which, I mean, you're sitting there with usually two people in the room. I think that there are instances here in Oregon where it can just be one, but you're with someone for 6 to 8 hours, right? And usually you're sitting there, and this is not, I really want to be clear, like this is not like taking mushrooms and going out with your friends and looking at the cool trees and whatever. Like, you are actually sitting on a couch usually with a blindfold on, listening to classical music. For like 6 hours with someone there that's there in case like anxiety comes up to help you through it. They're prompting you to be very open to the experience, to approach things, right? There's a lot of people that are afraid of bad trips. And what I've seen a lot in terms of facilitation strategies is that you're actually coached to approach things, right? Like if some demon figure comes up, they tell you to approach it with curiosity, to not run away from it, to look at it, to understand it, right? And so if you think about that, that's a therapeutic approach, right? Of really trying to get you to not avoid things, to approach things with curiosity, right? And so what I'm really trying to get at is that this, the clinical trials around this are around the entire experience. They're not around the drug itself, right? And then after the session, you do the session, then there's integration sessions that you do with the facilitator as well, where you go back and you talk about what happened, you talk about how you can maybe incorporate those lessons into your life and bring them into your relationships, into all of these different things. So there's a lot going on here. And that makes this really difficult to study in terms of what is actually producing out of all of that stuff that I just mentioned, what may actually be producing, like someone feeling less depressed or someone being able to eat more that has anorexia nervosa, right? It gets really tricky.
Right. And another obvious difficulty with these things is it's really hard to develop a placebo control for this kind of thing, because with other drugs, you know, if you take amphetamine, right, it's possible to take a placebo and feel like you got some stimulatory effects, right? But it's really not very likely that if you take a placebo, you're going to have the sort of mind-bending, consciousness-altering, life-changing experience of, you know, taking psilocybin or LSD or even ketamine, which we'll talk about later. So that makes these studies really hard to do in kind of the gold standard of clinical research, which is these double-blind placebo-controlled trials, meaning that neither the scientists nor the patient know what drug they're taking, because you know, you get 30 minutes into having taken the drug and it becomes obvious probably to the patient if they got a placebo or if they got the drug, and probably to the therapist as well. So that's called breaking blind, where you're breaking that sort of blind aspect of the trial. It's still technically placebo controlled, but it makes it a lot harder to isolate the effect of the drug versus all these other things that Taylor was talking about too.
And let's really think about this, right? Because let's say you're doing some type of, you want to do a double blind study with these, right? It's really easy to tell that you got a psychedelic, especially a high dose of a psychedelic, which most of these are, right? I mean, you're taking quite a bit of psilocybin when you're doing these. And I think that the really important thing to cue in on is not necessarily that the subject is no longer blind, but that the facilitator is no longer blind. Because if you're doing two sessions, one with someone that got a placebo and one with someone that got psychedelics, that 6 to 8 hours is going to look very different with those two people, right? And I've heard kind of anecdotal stories from people that have done these kind of trials, and they're like, oh, you know, I got a placebo guy. I got 6 hours. I got to sit there with this person that's not very talkative. But then you get in a room with someone that's on psychedelics, and it's like, whoa, what are you seeing? Like, how, right? It's a very very different experience. And that can very much play into the therapeutic alliance that happens within that 6 to 8 hours, right? And is that kind of rapport, that trust that you're building with the therapist, adding to the benefit that you're getting from this at the end compared to someone that just sat there for six to eight hours that didn't have any kind of an experience, that's just kind of sitting in a room with someone, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess there is a small exception to this with microdosing studies. There's not a ton of studies on microdosing, but this is the idea of taking a so-called sub-threshold dose of one of these substances, whether it's LSD or psilocybin, where you're not getting those really potent psychedelic effects. And in fact, that's kind of how microdosing is defined in a lot of the literature, that it's just... Yeah. The dose below which you won't get an actual effect. And so those, it's easier to do placebo controlled trials, and those have been done, and there's some like interesting findings with those, but it definitely doesn't mirror the kind of like profound amazing effects of the full dose psychedelic studies. So There's like some difficulty there, but I guess there are some ways of doing this where you can technically do double blind placebo controlled trials with psychedelics.
And I think that brings up something really interesting, right? Because I think that there's a lot of interest right now in developing pharmaceuticals that maybe hit these receptors in a similar way. We're going to talk in a little bit about kind of what it does to neuroplasticity, what it might be doing to the way these different brain regions are communicating with each other. But there's a lot of interest in trying to create a pharmaceutical that does what psychedelics are doing without the subjective effects. And it really kind of brings the question up to bear of, are the effects that we're seeing with depression and with all of these other things that are being studied, with addiction, end of life stuff, does it have more to do with the subjective effects, with actually going through a psychedelic journey, going through this kind of existential, like facing yourself and your fears kind of thing? Or is it all just biological? Is it just opening up kind of certain windows of neuroplasticity, whatever it may be? And that's what a lot of people that are into the kind of microdosing world are trying to understand, is like, if I take a sub-threshold kind of version of this, am I still getting the benefits of it? And like Andrew said, there have been some studies, some good studies that are looking at kind of double blind way of whether or not microdosing LSD does something. And there's been some like slight evidence that you get some stimulant properties, that you might get some kind of antidepressant properties, but it's not a huge effect. And something that we really want to get clear on too is that a lot of the studies that have been done have been really small sample sizes. Right. And one of the really good kind of metaphors that I've heard used for this, right? If you went out and just interviewed 30 people, let's say you interviewed 50 people and you asked them who they were going to vote for president, with it being a nice election year this year, right? You wouldn't really trust that those 50 people would be representative of everyone in America or everyone in whatever country you're listening from, right? And that's the case with this too, where like there could be a lot of selection bias of people that really want to go and have a psychedelic journey, and they believe that it's going to do something. That's what they call expectancy effects, right? You go in and you're like, I've heard that these are amazing, right? And so you go in and you come out and you're like, it had to have done something. And then that's almost a placebo effect, right? You're coming out with like, it did something, right? We don't want to be like a downer on people's parades, though, because there are a lot of people that really are excited about the potential with this kind of stuff. And I am too. Like, a lot of these results look really, really fascinating. And if they do hold up, it's going to be really cool. But one of the things that we're seeing is that the bigger the sample sizes get, the smaller the effect sizes are getting, which when you get to a really big sample. So we have to look at like the phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 trials to make this a medicinal thing, to make it something that someone can actually prescribe. And phase 3 is usually the largest sample sizes that we're looking at. And that's like 300 to 500 people. And so you have to think, like, we're in phase 2 with psilocybin. We've gotten to phase 3 with MDMA here in America. But phase 2, you're only looking at like 100 to 150 people, right? And you're going to have a lot of people that are self-selecting into that wanted to do this in the first place. There are a lot of people that are like, oh, well, we've done this on naive people that have never done psychedelics before. But you're always open to the idea of people lying too, because they want to be in the study. And so they'll say that they never did it before so that they can be in the study, right? There's lots of stuff that kind of feed into this. And so again, we don't want to like rain on everybody's parade. I really think that these this stuff is incredible, and especially what it's doing to the brain. But we just want people to know what to look out for in terms of picking apart what's hype and what might actually be real.
Yeah, the really good point. Because, I mean, just personally, I know some people who have done like ketamine-assisted therapy. And ketamine's a little bit different. We'll talk about that. But it seems to work through a common mechanism similar to psychedelics, at least at slower doses. And like just talking to these people anecdotally have described it as a profound experience, life-changing experience, you know, relieving depression or anxiety. And so like, I don't know if we mentioned this yet. The reason that a lot of this hype is, or this hype is there, or why there's so much excitement around this is that when you compare the effects of, in some of these studies, granted small sample sizes, difficulties with all the kinds of, you know, placebo controlled stuff we've been talking about, all of this, that nonetheless, there have been these, findings that a single dose of psilocybin in this psychotherapy setting is more effective than the conventional antidepressants like SSRIs. So there's work by the neuroscientist Robin Carhart-Harris, who is one of the main guys in this area and has shown that. But again, like this is all subject to all of these limitations that we're talking about here. And it's still super interesting because if that's true, if you can get that that effect of just like diminishing depression in one session or, you know, three sessions versus having years of psychotherapy combined with years of taking like an SSRI, that's pretty amazing. And if that's true, that could lead to, you know, scaling these to allowing people to, I mean, we have a really big problem with mental illness right now. We have this crisis of depression and anxiety in this country and in the developed world generally. And so if this can become a scalable solution, that would be an amazing breakthrough. And so like, I don't want to rain on anybody's parade either, but we do need to be like careful about talking about, you know, how far along the science is. And I think that's the balance we're trying to strike here.
Yeah, no, I think so too. And I think the one thing that we haven't mentioned is cost. Right. That right now, this is really expensive. I know it's a lot less expensive in Oregon than I've heard it is in Europe. I've heard like 10,000 euros or 10,000 euros in Europe. it's significantly less. I think it's a couple thousand to go through the whole thing in Oregon. But still, insurance is probably not going to cover this. They're going to see this as the cost of more than a year, if not multiple years worth of SSRI depressants, antidepressants, right? And the effect sizes in these large sample sizes aren't much bigger than we're seeing from SSRIs as these samples have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And so what I'm really kind of curious about is whether or not we're going to identify certain populations that might be more kind of suitable for this type than others, right? That it might not just be for everyone, but there might be a certain clinical population that this is a really good treatment for. And that I think is really incredible to dig in. I want this work to continue. I want to know more. And especially as we're kind of transitioning now, I want to know more about like how it's affecting the brain. Like, what is it that is really causing these profound experiences, right? Because one of the things that we really want to get into as we start kind of exploring the brain stuff is why might it be doing these things therapeutically, right? Why might it have an effect on someone with depression, on someone with anorexia nervosa, on someone with addiction, right? And a lot of those things are identified as being something that are involved with rigidity in thinking, right? Involved with being in these loops, these depression rumination loops, being in these addictive loops, being in these obsessive compulsive loops, right? That you're very tied into a particular way of doing things. And some of the evidence with the brain could be indicating that it's opening the brain up outside of these kind of preconceived kind of rigid ways of thinking, which if we can learn more about that, I think it's going to be fascinating to see how that then maps back on.
Yeah. And I think as we transition into talking about some of this neuroscience, you mentioned MDMA a minute ago, and I just want to like be clear with people. While MDMA has some similarities to the classic psychedelics that we've been talking about, the reason we haven't talked about it much is it's really not considered a psychedelic by most researchers in the field because it has a very different mechanism and a different effect on cognition. So it typically doesn't have the kind of like hallucination effects that psychedelics do. But that being said, just as an aside, MDMA is further along, as Taylor mentioned, and it's in phase three trials for especially for PTSD. So it's been it's shown some really amazing results for treating PTSD. So just putting that aside for a second, maybe we'll talk about MDMA in a future episode, but to get into that, what is that mechanism that's different? So we kind of mentioned earlier that psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin, DMT, these work primarily on a specific receptor in the brain called the serotonin 2A receptor. And serotonin is this super complex neurotransmitter system in the brain. It has, I think there's seven different receptor subtypes. But 2A, the 2A receptor is one of the most common. It's one of the most common in the brain. And these substances seem to stimulate this receptor. And that kind of helps to explain some of the psychological effects as well as what we're going to talk about, kind of these neuroplasticity enhancing effects of psychedelics.
Something that I found that's really, really interesting around these 5-HT2A receptors is they seem to be really heavily allocated to regions of the cortex that are more advanced in Homo sapiens compared to other animals. In areas of the brain that we would call association cortex. So these are areas of the brain that are integrating information from multiple senses. They're heavily integrated in the and visual cortex, which would explain a lot of the visual properties of these things. But then they're also heavily located in kind of the higher end of the processing hierarchy, which what that means essentially is that there seems to be a hierarchical progression of the way that information moves through the brain, from simple sensory stuff to our awareness of objects to entire narratives, right? Our ability to put those objects into a story, into a place, put into a memory, into the future, all of that kind of stuff. And we've talked before on this this podcast about the default mode network quite a bit. And that would be kind of the high end of the hierarchy. And there seems to be a lot of these receptors kind of in that network. There seems to be a lot of kind of influence of these on that network that we'll kind of get into. But that was something that was really interesting to me is kind of where these things are located. And as we kind of dig into some of these effects, it might explain a lot about the different ways in which humans think and what these kind of naturally might be for without the kind of psychedelic trip that's necessary.
Right. Yeah. And I think this maybe is just a good point to mention, like, why is it that serotonin itself, when you increase levels of serotonin, that doesn't lead to psychedelic experiences in the same way, or it doesn't seem to. And it probably has to do with the fact that these drugs are targeting specifically this 2A system. So there's something about this 5-HT2A receptor that leads to these psychedelic experiences. However, as we mentioned earlier, there are drugs that have been developed now that don't have the psychedelic properties and yet stimulate the 2A receptor. So it gets a little bit complicated on what exactly is like going on here and how these particular drugs are affecting the system. And it gets into pharmacology and molecular biology, and we won't go too deep into that. But yeah, just to mention that is seems to be like the difference. But the other thing to mention is they're not only interacting with these receptors, they're also having effects on other receptors in the brain, other serotonin receptors. So this is kind of like the most well-known pathway of what's going on, the most seems to explain the most about the psychedelic experience. And yet there's a lot more going on that we just simply don't understand yet about what psychedelics are doing to the rest of the serotonin system and the rest of the brain.
And we do know that the psychedelic, like, mind-altering experiences seem to really be really heavily tied to this part of the system, because if you block the 5-HT2A receptors and then give someone psilocybin or LSD, they don't have the hallucinations and the psychedelic experience. But we have to keep in mind that the brain is entangled, right? That there's a lot of downstream consequences of this thing being on that's now affecting this system. There's a lot going on here. I think something that's really important as we kind of get into this brain stuff is that this is really new science, right? There are people that have been studying this for like 30 years, they've been studying kind of the molecular side of this. And now we're kind of getting into the subjective side, because now we're studying humans, and we have to have humans that are willing to come into the lab and do a psychedelic trip for 6 hours and sit in an MRI machine that's like, bah, 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 right? Like there's a lot that goes into being able to actually study this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Just I wanted to touch on, as we kind of get into the theories of really what's happening here, I wanted to touch on one theory that relates directly to the serotonin system. This comes primarily from the scientists Robin Carhart-Harris, who we've mentioned, as well as David Nutt, who have done a lot of super interesting research in this area. And they are coming from this perspective of what is different about psychedelics compared to other drugs that increase serotonin, namely the serotonin, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So those are SSRIs, the kind of canonical classic antidepressants. Those also increase serotonin. And their theory that they presented a good amount of evidence for, I don't know that it's completely accepted or if it's could be expanded on or changed in the future, but this idea that there are these two most common receptors in the serotonin system are the 1A receptor and the 2A receptor. And they've shown that the 1A receptor is more highly expressed in kind of subcortical regions of the brain, in areas that are involved really in kind of feeling, sort of like the limbic system, the we might call emotional or arousal system, things like that. Whereas this 2A receptor, as Taylor was mentioning, has this much higher expression in the cortex, especially in visual cortex, association cortex, the claustrum, which we'll talk about later, but these higher order areas that are more involved in like thinking, in higher level perception and stuff like that. And so the idea is like SSRIs, the way that they work to have this antidepressant effect is they kind of tamp down the activity of these subcortical regions like the amygdala, areas that are involved in kind of our anxiety or our feeling of anxiety, things like that. They're kind of tamping that activity down because this 1A receptor is inhibitory, and it seems that SSRIs more selectively target the 1A receptor. And then when it comes to psychedelics, the reason that they have an antidepressant effect primarily is that they're altering this cortical system, opening up a window of neuroplasticity and allowing for more like reframing, changing your perception of reality, of who you are as a person. And so there's this kind of different way that these drugs are affecting this serotonin system, and that may help to explain why there's, these different kinds of effects, but similarly having antidepressant effects. Sorry, I know that was a mouthful.
No, let's dig into that last part, because there were a couple of things that you said that I think we should really unpack. And that's, first of all, there's a lot of hype around these producing a window of plasticity, that it seems to be that activating these 5-HT2A receptors are creating this downstream effect of getting glutamate going and releasing what's called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic growth factor, right? But ultimately, what we think is happening from activating these things is that it is producing spine growth, which is a type of neuroplasticity. And so this is like the neurons reaching out to make connections with other neurons. It's not creating new neurons, but it's creating new connections. And it's opening up a window of plasticity, where in this moment, when all of this stuff is active and these things are flowing, there seems to be this period where a lot of new connections can happen. which is really fascinating. And there's a lot of pharmaceutical companies that are trying to engage this mechanism without producing the kind of psychedelic effects, because they're saying, you know, if we can open up plasticity and we can get people to start thinking differently, or we can get people that have like movement disorders to start moving differently, then those new connections are gonna stay and they're gonna happen, right? But the other part of what Andrew said was that there seems to be this opening up of the way that you're thinking about yourself, about past experiences, about certain traumas, about all of these kind of things. And that's the really kind of interesting thing that a lot of researchers are trying to dig into and trying to understand, is that, like, yeah, this idea of neuroplasticity is cool. There's a lot of other drugs that open up that window of plasticity too, right? But there's something about that then being paired with a different type of flow of information. And he mentioned Robin Carhart Harris. And Robin Carhart Harris, along with someone named Carl Friston, have proposed what's called the Rebus model, R-E-B-U-S. And it's this idea that we're relaxing a lot of the top-down stuff in our brain. So if you think about depression, right? If you think about obsessive compulsive type disorders, or things like anorexia nervosa or addiction or anything like this, that, like I said earlier, are really marked by this rigid way of thinking, of constantly being stuck in these top-down perceptions about who I am and what I need and everything that's going wrong in my life, or things that need to be like stable in my environment. What they think is going on is that stuff is being relaxed. That it's disrupting a lot of the network architecture that creates those loops. And because of that, it's also opening up what he calls a window of entropy. So entropy in kind of physics is this idea of like chaos, right? Of things creating disorder. And what you see when you take psychedelics is a very like desynchronized activity all over the brain. That it seems that these neurons that express this 2A receptor in kind of the fourth and fifth layer of the cortex seem to have this ability to really introduce a lot of noise into the system, to open up these channels and to really kind of disrupt the networks that hold all of these kind of top-down beliefs that we have about ourselves.
Yeah, and that relates to something, I don't know, I don't think we mentioned it earlier on, I think I meant to, but one of the common experiences, especially in these psychedelic assisted psychotherapy sessions, is something called ego dissolution, or this feeling of oceanic boundlessness. It's something that is not unique necessarily to the psychedelic experience. It's been, you know, reported in meditation and other things like that, that are kind of what it is very hard to describe in words, right? But it's this loss of the sort of sense of like who you are and the boundaries of what you are. And, you know, some people think that's you sort of tapping into what the actual foundational baseline consciousness of your brain is it's the self is a kind of construct that we're building through these network interactions. And we've talked about the default mode network before on this show. And so one of the common things that people hear about is like that psychedelics disrupt the activity of the default mode network, and default mode network being involved in these self-generating, these self-related processes. And that's true. But as Taylor mentioned, it's not only that it's disrupting the default mode network. There's evidence that it's disrupting a lot of these associative networks. And that kind of goes into another model of the of psychedelic action in the brain that may be complementary, or it may be just a different model entirely when it comes down to it. But this one called the cortico-claustro-cortical model, or CCC model. And it's basically this idea that there's this area of the brain called the claustrum, which seems to kind of regulate the interactions between the association networks. So networks involved in like cognitive control that we've talked about before, kind of acting as a switch between these networks almost. And there's a high concentration of these 5-HT2A receptors in the claustrum. And there's evidence that when people take psychedelics, that it changes the activity of the claustrum, and it sort of takes that conductor offline. It takes that regulatory function offline. So that starts to explain why you see this desynchronization in networks that are usually synchronized. Again, I know that's a mouthful. It's a lot. Let's try to dig into it.
Let's hone in on the colostrum, because the colostrum is fascinating. So Francis Crick, a lot of people probably know that name from like Watson and Crick that discovered the structure of DNA, right? A lot of people don't know that Francis Crick actually got really into the neuroscience side of things later in life and was trying to find the seat of consciousness. And I don't know how true this is, but there's like these anecdotal stories that he like went to his deathbed, like it's the colostrum. Like that's what's producing consciousness. But it's this idea, the reason they came to that conclusion is because the colostrum is one of the most densely connected areas in the entire brain, that it is connected to almost everything in like the higher order scheme of things, all of these different association cortices, these different networks, right? And Andrew kind of hinted at it, that there seems to be this kind of conductor-like role that the colostrum has in like, okay, this needs to be connected to that and this. And it, so it could be like connecting the synchronization that's happening across these different regions so that things are kind of firing in sync with one another. But what happens with this thing being densely kind of covered in these 5-HT2A receptors, you just completely disrupt its ability to do this conducting, right? And so now you have all of these things that used to be in sync with one another that now maybe these two are in sync and they never talk to each other, right? And now you have these synesthesia type things where you have like sound and color are on at the same time when they shouldn't be, right? And now you have this conscious experience of like red, beautiful notes from the music that you're hearing, right? And so it's this really interesting idea, the like entropic, anarchic brain, anarchy, that like there just seems to be this kind of disruption of the normal way that all of these things are talking to each other. And so that really kind of plays into what we were talking about earlier, because if you can find something meaningful in the chaos, right? Of these things connecting in different ways, right? Now you not seeing yourself the same way, you feeling this idea of ego disillusion, like Andrew hinted at, that might open you up to saying like, wow, the way that I saw things really rigidly might not be true. And now I have some connections in my brain that are solidifying the fact that like, wow, I was seeing things really rigidly, and now I've seen them another way, and I have this neuroplasticity that kind of saved a lot of this stuff and showed me all of these things and maybe saved memories of it. I don't know.
Yeah, it's really interesting to like compare these models, because they're often like, I don't know, competing with each other, but it does seem like at least some of them do converge on this idea of like, you're disrupting the usual activity of the brain and enhancing plasticity that is kind of changing the connections in the way that Taylor described. And I don't know, do you want to, I guess we have kind of one that those two seem to me to address some of the like changes in beliefs and thoughts about ourself and our situation and changing, allowing us to like form new connections. But then there's this whole other side of the psychedelic experience that Taylor hinted at, with kind of synesthesia and talking about the perceptual hallucinations and things like that. And so there's other researchers, there's other models that propose to kind of explain how psychedelics are actually inducing those hallucinations or changing our perception of reality. And those are really interesting, but there, some of them are in contradiction. So maybe let's, So you want to jump into the first one?
So I think the first one's not totally in contradiction, because there's another one called the filter model that really just kind of ties to attention. All right, that's something that we hinted a lot at the beginning of this episode, was that our attention mechanisms are a filter, right? We have all of the sensory information coming in, and then we have these mechanisms that break all that down and categorize it and put it together into objects and things and filter out everything that we don't need, right? Because when you really think about what comes to awareness, it's usually the things that are important to us, that are important to our goals, important to maintaining our relationships, right? Information about us, right? And what a lot of the research has shown, and this has always been something that was just fascinating to me looking at attention, is that there were these competing theories early on about whether or not there was late selection or early selection. So late selection would mean that all of this sensory stuff was processed, and then at the end of the stage, our brain was like, okay, I need that and I need that, throw away everything else, right? early selection would mean that before anything was processed, we already knew what to filter out. And there's actually some really interesting evidence that shows that super, super early on in the sensory processing that the filtering is actually happening, all the way down to the thalamus. And the thalamus is like where all of the sensory stuff comes in first. And there's evidence that shows that like the stuff that we need gets filtered out before it even gets to the cortex, right? And there's a lot of evidence from psychedelics that that process in the thalamus is getting disrupted. And so and this kind of ties into a lot of the other stuff that we just mentioned, where if you're taking the filter off completely and you're just allowing everything to get in, not stuff that's dictated by your goals or your beliefs about who you are or anything like this, then you're just kind of feeling the flood of sensory information. Right? You're just kind of letting the sensory world wash over you. And I think a lot of people that have experienced these types of psychedelic experiences, that's kind of how it feels in terms of emotions flooding over you, in terms of colors and experiences. The world seems more vivid, right? That everything is just kind of being kind of shown to you in a really kind of clear, unfiltered way. And that's been kind of the basis of these three theories that we've talked about, is that the filter's gone. It's interrupting, it's introducing like all of this crazy noise. There's regions of the brains talking to each other that don't usually talk to each other, right? But everything in those theories is bottom up. It's all saying that like we're removing the filter and everything you're experiencing is from this bottom up processing. But then there's this other theory that is contradictory to that and has a lot to do with the hallucination side of things. Because if we're completely turning off all of our top down stuff, then what's producing hallucinations? Which seem to be things about what we care about our beliefs. If you look at like DMT, people that do DMT that end up seeing these like crazy, like elaborate hallucinations, a lot of it is built on prior belief. If they go in with like prior beliefs about religiosity or something, they tend to have kind of visions that kind of mirror what they already know and what they already see. And I know that there's like stuff that doesn't fit that mold, but there is a lot of that. And so, how can we like not have a filter, but then still have some type of architecture to make sense of all this information that's coming in?
Yeah. Something I just thought of as you were saying that I hadn't really considered before is if you think about the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, we mentioned that part of it is one of the common features of it is you're blindfolded. You're not taking in any visual data, right? Yet, people are having these rich visual experiences. And maybe that has to do with the visual cortex having such a high concentration of 2A receptors. It's being stimulated and it's just generating its own activity outside of, without any kind of visual input, right? Seeing with the brain, right, and not with the eyes in some sense. But that's a really good point. I wanted to go back to when you're talking about the eliminating the filter or sort of relaxing this top-down control over perception. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things one of the ideas that really kind of convinced me or just made me think about this was I can't remember which researcher it was, but they were talking about how, one of the very common experiences with psychedelics is this thing of visual trails. So like if you move your hand across your visual field, typically when you're not on psychedelics, you just see like a smooth motion of your hand across your visual field, right? That's a normal thing. But if you're taking psychedelics, one of the really common perceptual distortions is that you see a kind of trail of your hand moving across your face, almost like you're seeing, sort of imprints of your hand moving across your visual field. And the idea there is like this idea that we're relaxing the top-down processing over perception could help to explain why visual trails happen. Because in order for you to see a smooth line, a smooth trajectory of your hand across your visual field, your brain has to predict where your hand is going to be to be able to do that. That's kind of the idea. So if you break down that prediction process, that top-down control over perception, then you're seeing like this series of images of your hand moving across your visual field. And so that's, I don't know if you would consider that probably not a hallucination, but it's a visual distortion that may be explained by this enhanced bottom-up processing.
I think that's a really important distinction, because we've been talking about top down versus bottom up. A lot of the times when people are talking about top down, they're talking about the predictive brain hypothesis, that what the brain is doing is actually creating an internal model that's trying to predict the outside world. And then what it's doing is it's checking with the sensory information to see if it's right. And that would be a prediction error, right? We have this internal model of what we think is happening, where our hand should be going, and then we're checking that with the actual sensory data, right? And what's happening, what a lot of people think is happening, is that we're relaxing a lot of that prediction stuff. We're not actually predicting, and we're just like, things are just coming in and kind of being interpreted in just kind of a random way. I really like that framework. It's hard to say that it's capturing everything, though, because I think one of the hallmarks of the psychedelic trip is the existential side of it, that we're, that the people that are going through these experiences are facing very kind of internalized concrete representations of their fears, of their traumas, of the things that have been holding them back, right? And so there's got to be something that's still maintaining some type of structure in the brain, I think. Because if it's just this like random chaos that like everything is desynchronized, then why aren't we just like a blob, right? Why are we able to still have this like coherent train of thought and also come out of it with a memory of the experience, right? And I mean, there's a lot of people that talk about it being ineffable, that there's a lot of things that they can't put into words, but there still is a recollection of the experience itself. And so I think that these models are doing a great job at trying to get us there and trying to understand like, okay, this may be producing a less rigid structure. And that's something that really resonates with me. Because think about it for a second, right? These 2A receptors are not there for psychedelics, right? Those 2A receptors are there for natural serotonin to hit. So what are they doing naturally that the psychedelics are now just amping up? And something that really sticks out to me is that we have to go through our daily lives in a flexible pattern of being rigid with some things, but then being open to new experiences to be able to learn, right? And so what I think may be going on is that these are facilitating a learning process where we're open to a new way of creating our internal model. It's this idea of accommodation, right? So it's one thing to just stick with our negative beliefs about ourselves, about how we're going to fail, about who we are, about all of these things. It's another thing entirely to relax that and to consider evidence that might not be true, right? And that in itself, right? Think about why that would be producing neuroplasticity, right? If I'm rigidly doing something, if I'm doing something habitually, I don't need to learn. I don't need to lay down any new connections because I'm doing it the same way that I've always been doing it. But now, if I'm going to be open to new information, if I'm going to accommodate new information into the system, then I need some method that first introduces new information into the system and then allows for that new information to then be recorded into a new model that I'm creating, right? And I think that what's happening from my, I mean, this is all kind of speculation at this point, but I think that we're seeing this just like this hyper, like rocket speed trajectory of turning that system into high gear, where it's not, I don't think producing just complete chaos, like this idea of just complete anarchy, but it is opening us up completely. And one of the things that brought me there, and I know this is kind of long-winded, but they've done these things where they show personality trait kind of judgments after you go through a psychedelic experience. And so someone will record like, okay, this is how extroverted I am. This is how introverted, how agreeable, how open, right? They showed, I think like, I'm paraphrasing, but I think it was like a 70 percentile jump in openness, trait openness after these psychedelic experiences, where all of a sudden now I had this psychedelic experience and now me as a person am now more open to experience, more open to new information and new things, right? That's huge to me. And I think that could be a really kind of plausible pathway that is relating all of these symptomologies and all of these treatments to being beneficial, is that we're finding more balance between rigidity and flexibility.
Yeah, that relates directly to the researchers we've already mentioned, Robin Carhart-Harris and David Nutt. They had this hypothesis of what the serotonin system is for generally. And it's this idea that serotonin generally is kind of the system for dealing with adversity, dealing with stress. And one of the things that activates the 2A receptor naturally is kind of extreme stress or chronic stress. But the idea here is like, this is a really complex system. The serotonin system is super complex. And there are these two major arms of it that we've mentioned. The 1A system, which is primarily centered in those subcortical regions, and the 2A system, right? And this idea that when we encounter stress, that the 1A system is kind of for taking, they use the term like emotional blunting. So like taking the edge off of that experience, sort of just turning down those sort of regions involved in anxiety and arousal and like kind of our feelings. And then there's this 2A system that is for reframing, changing our understanding and confronting the source of our stress. And I think we can all see how those two kind of like types of dealing with stress or dealing with adversity are essential. And I think it relates to what Taylor's saying about rigidity and about flexibility, because I think this 1A system has a lot to do with kind of our rigid or inflexible response to stress, where it's more like, okay, I'm just going to hunker down and let it pass, right? This relates to stuff we've talked about regarding learned helplessness and the effect of the serotonin system in actually promoting learned helplessness, because it has this release of serotonin. I'm not going to go too deep into that, but but just expanding on that idea that there are these two different systems, perhaps, that are kind of for dealing with adversity in the brain. And what the psychedelics are doing is tapping into that 2A system, that system that's more for reformulating your understanding of yourself and reality and reframing, stressful experiences and kind of opening that window of plasticity to go into that more flexible mode that Taylor is talking about. So again, yeah, we're speculating here, but I think what we're saying is largely in line with a lot of researchers are saying, including Carhart-Harris and David Nutt.
I know we're like about at time. I have a pet theory, and this is speculation, but it very much kind of plays off what you just said. From everything that I've seen about dopamine and serotonin, it seems to me like there's this seesaw kind of thing happening, where dopamine is very much about like going out in the world and getting things, like go out and accomplish those things, get those goals, figure those things out, right? So it's motivating you to explore, right? And I've always kind of seen the serotonin system as kind of being the system that goes, okay, we need to go explore, but can we, right? And it's kind of creating this internal model of what are our resources, right? Do I have the energy to go out and do that thing? It's looking at past memories, right? The raphe nucleus for the serotonin system is very kind of connected and right there around like these memory systems, hippocampus and all of this thing. So it's saying, have I succeeded in the past, right? Can I accomplish that thing, right? And when you really look at this and you kind of tie it all together with what we've just talked about, right? When you see kind of these illnesses that are marked by maybe low serotonin, right? You take an antidepressant, it brings these serotonin levels up. You have these psychedelics that are bringing serotonin levels up, that it tends to bring you more into an explorative mode, right? Depression is marked by psychomotor retardation of saying like, no, I'm not going to go out and explore. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to hunker down. I'm going to conserve my resources, right? And I think that that's also kind of linked to this idea of rigid thinking, right? Because if I keep doing things the way that I've been doing them, then I know exactly how much resource I'm going to use to do that, right? But if you feel safe, if you feel like you have what you need, like you're in a context that's supportive and your serotonin levels start to rise, now you're more open to new information, new ways of doing things. You feel more comfortable about your capabilities, right? And I think that that might be kind of playing in with what we're seeing with some of this stuff, that maybe these 1A systems are kind of connected to these kind of integral, like motivation. Do I have the resources? Can I succeed? And then the other side of that is like, okay, now that I believe I can succeed, can I experience this new information and bring it into my internal model to like view the world in a different way? And again, that's my pet theory, right? I don't have like data to support this, but it seems that a lot of this stuff around learned helplessness, around dopamine and all of these things kind of tie into this idea. And so I know this is kind of the end of where we're at. This has been a really cool one because again, I want to emphasize that like there is a lot of promise with these treatments. And what we're kind of getting at is that we're seeing mechanisms that might be hinting at something really powerful if we can really work them out. But approach this with caution, right? Don't just give in to the hype and run with it, because there still is a lot of methodological hurdles that we have to jump to be able to really come to strong conclusions about whether or not this is a good treatment for everyone.
Yeah. And we know that it's not a good treatment for everybody already. And that's something I kind of will end on a bit of a downer note, but it's something I think we need to mention, that one of the main things that they use to screen people out of these psychedelic psychotherapy sessions is if you have a predisposition to psychosis or schizophrenia, or if, you know, people in your family have it. Because these drugs can precipitate psychotic episodes for people who have a predisposition to schizophrenia. That's not to say that they will make everybody go crazy or anything like that. It's that people who already have the predisposition toward psychosis or schizophrenia are much more likely to have a psychotic episode when they're taking a psychedelic. So, I want to end with that, because just on a cautionary note and just circling back to all these methodological issues we talked about, combined with all the excitement we've been showing about the interesting mechanisms and the possibility of treatment and the future of this stuff, I think is so super exciting and interesting. But just, have a, a sober mind about it and be clear-headed and don't just go out and this is not an invitation to just go start taking psychedelics all the time, but it's super interesting and it might be could be revolutionary.
No, and that's actually a point that I want to make. I know that I haven't mentioned it yet. We are not encouraging anybody to do this illicitly. We know that these are illegal in the vast majority of the places that people might be listening to this in. And we are not condoning that. So just want to put that up there.
Absolutely. But yeah.
Thank you for listening, because this one, I got to say, was really fun to dive into. There's so much research out there. We mentioned a lot of prominent researchers today. So if you want to dive deeper, just research any of those people's names. And there's tons of YouTube videos. There's tons of papers, lots of stuff that you can get into to really figure out if this is something that's interesting to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And check out other episodes of The Social Brain to learn more about some of the stuff we've talked about, like learned helplessness. We have an episode on that. We also have one on all these brain networks that we mentioned, like the default mode network and all this stuff. So check that out. We will put a link somewhere in the description to those videos, but definitely go learn more about that. See if you what you think about what we've said here. And then we'll be back in a couple of weeks, likely, for another episode. So stay tuned, and thank you, everybody, for watching.
We'll see you for the next one.